Welcome to our show, Examine Life, on KKRN at 88.5 FM in Bella Vista at Round Mountain.
This is Examine Life. I'm Steve.
I'm Pat.
Plato said that the unexamined life is not worth living. So on the first and third Monday of each month, we'll examine aspects of life and human nature.
Tonight, we're going to examine entrepreneurs and inventors, what it takes to be an entrepreneur.
And what the definition of an entrepreneur
is.
According to the SBA, an entrepreneur is a person who organizes and manages a business undertaking, assuming the risk for the sake of profit. An entrepreneur sees an opportunity, makes a plan, starts the business, manages the business, and receives the profits.
A more simple definition is a person who starts a business and is willing to risk loss in order to make money.
What really shows an entrepreneur to me, if you could say it in one word, is vision. The entrepreneurs that I've known seem to be people of vision. They see a situation, a widget or something, and they develop this vision of something that could be, and they happen to be a person who approaches detail in such a way that they put together the parts of this vision and make it happen.
Most of us see problems and irritations throughout our daily life. An entrepreneur sees opportunities. He sees more efficient ways to accomplish a job. And so he doesn't limit his universe by the rote process of doing something over and over. He looks more to, wow, I could make this easier or better.
And he's not intimidated by the possibility of failure and not intimidated by the possibility of financial loss. I think for an entrepreneur, they have to do what they do. I don't know that they cannot do it.
Well, I think most entrepreneurs are spirited. They have this determination, this drive. Someone once said that people are sometimes distracted by shiny new opportunities. That's the entrepreneur. That's an opportunity he gets distracted with that he knows he can solve.
And has the mental and emotional tools to solve it. I think with every different type of human being, there's a combination of mental and emotional assets. And in the case of an entrepreneur, they have the ability to be distracted by that shiny new opportunity, but they also have the ability to focus their mind when it needs to be focused, and the ability to see the big picture, along with the ability to see all the little pieces of the picture as well, and put that together and make the vision happen.
That's initiative. Most of them have determination to see it through, and they have the ability to take risk. That's the hardest thing for most of us to do, is to have a daring enough spirit to take a risk at the possibility of loss or failure.
Right. And the thing is, we're taking a risk every day. We just, I think if we don't see the obvious risk, then we're not afraid. But every time you get into a car, you're taking a risk. You know, I've heard the discussion about faith. Someone says, I don't need faith. And I have to say, well, unless you're an engineer and you drove over that bridge, you had a lot of faith.
And I think the entrepreneur has faith in himself. He has confidence, and his confidence overrules his fear of failure or his fear of not being able to perform somehow in this vision that he has.
Again, probably partially because he doesn't have a choice. An entrepreneur sees a situation and they just feel like they have to intervene and build this thing that they've seen a picture of. And I don't know that they can't not do that.
And they also have that willingness to take that leap of faith in themselves that they can do it. They can accomplish that. Whatever that opportunity is that they see a solution for.
Exactly. And as time goes on in life, you start to notice how people are put together and how people evolve. And you can see this thing from childhood. You can see an entrepreneur versus a worker bee. A worker bee goes out there and says, I need some money. Where can I get a job? And an entrepreneur says, I need some money. How can I make it?
This brings me, the kid idea brings me to Tom Sawyer. And there's a difference between risk taker and avoiding responsibility. And although Tom Sawyer may have appeared to be a risk taker or an entrepreneur, he really wasn't. He was avoiding having to do the job when he got these kids to work for him.
Well, he was a risk taker. Being a big fan of Tom Sawyer, I'll pick apart what anybody says about it. The whole story is about taking chances, but he was taking a chance on Aunt Polly being upset about the way he got the fence painted. Aunt Polly didn't cotton to those kind of things, and he tricked all of his friends into painting the fence for him. But in the end, the job was done very well with multiple coats of paint in a much more shorter time.
But he was an opportunistic type of personality, not really an entrepreneur, even though he did get someone else to do the job for him.
That's accurate. He was one of those combinations I talked about earlier, and this combination was laziness and a little bit of an entrepreneurial spirit and a lot of brains.
But you look at kids who have that initiative and drive that, okay, I'm going to do a lemonade stand. Even though it's 10 cents a cup, they're going to make some money. Or they see a need, an event, or something's going on, and no one's got any water, so they go down someplace with a case of water bottles and sell water bottles. That's the entrepreneurial spirit that you see in kids.
That's right. And you mentioned Tom Sawyer being an opportunist. He was. And what separates an entrepreneur from him is that an entrepreneur sees opportunity, but then again has a vision and sees a picture and carries it through and continues to grow it and build it. That's the thing about an entrepreneur. They don't just stop with the successful start of a business. They go on and grow it into bigger and bigger things.
That's true. And you look at the guy that has a taco truck or someone who has a web-based business on eBay. They're working with the drive of making money, and they each have a different avenue in which they're taking that risk, but they're all banking on themselves. They've got guts and determination and the belief in themselves. They're going to rely on themselves to make money.
And this is a case where having a big ego is a positive thing, because you do have to have a big ego. You have to think that you can accomplish things where a lot of people would not think that about themselves and probably resent the entrepreneur for having that self-opinion. But, and again, it's what made our country great, was that kind of spirit. So ego is not a bad thing. It just depends on where it's applied.
Right. And our making money is unique to American capitalism, the idea of I'm going to sell you something. We've always been provided necessities that we were willing to pay for. But capitalism oftentimes creates a need or creates a drive for the product that was never there before, as in Apple computers.
Oh, absolutely. When Steve Jobs, Apple computers itself is a big story. But on the iPhone, you know, they came up with this concept of swiping on a smartphone. You know, there had been the Windows phones and so on already, but the idea of swiping it and making it act like a piece of paper or something like that, that had to be a vision that somebody had. And, you know, and then he had to push that through. He had to make them make it of the best quality possible.
And these are unique features to America. It's what created our middle class. And most entrepreneurs start out in the middle class or lower class even and develop something that oftentimes makes them rich. But, you know, oftentimes it also creates just the entrepreneur that provides a living for his family and two or three other families that he employs.
And that's one of the greatest things about entrepreneurialism. And being a business owner myself, I enjoy the thought that some people are taking home a paycheck because of what we built in our business. You can't take that to the bank, but that's a wonderful feeling. And the entrepreneur, there's nothing wrong with them wanting to have whatever size profit they want to have. Again, they took the risk. They're the ones putting together the operation. They're the ones organizing it all and carrying it through to the finish. And whatever profit they get from that is well-deserved.
And oftentimes an entrepreneur doesn't know really what his worth is as he starts out as an entrepreneur. He might, you know, you go back to the bartering system, and I want something and I'll trade you for me digging a ditch for you or doing manual labor, even though I don't know what that's really worth. But to me, it's worth that watch I want from you.
It's automatic for them. Instead of going to someone and looking for a job, they look for ways to trade resources. And it's a much freer thought process.
Yes, and our country was based on the idea of each individual has the right and freedom to own land and to use that land to create a craft or his labor to create a product, be it a watermelon, grow a watermelon and sell it, or you have a, you know, you run a blacksmith shop. But that's where tradesman or craftsman comes from, is the American spirit to create something and sell it or trade. His trade was worth selling into a business.
And it's still the same way. Money is just a representative of those products that you use to trade. And originally, that's where employment started. A man had a business. You mentioned the blacksmith shop. He made it successful, so he was very busy. He didn't have time to get water, so he needed someone to haul water for him. He had to pay the person to do it. And it was really an agreement between two people to trade one set of resources for another. And somehow it's evolved today into this complex web of family you have to be in when you hire someone.
Yes, but it can be simple. It can be basic service. A lot of us are in the service industry where we provide a service and we get either paid a commission or a flat amount, and that serves as our income rather than us actually creating a product or selling you food or something like that.
Well, and I agree. But that makes it no less valuable. As a matter of fact, most of the technological innovations we have today have created their own need. You know, the need for food and shelter and warmth and protection has been around since the beginning of biology. But the need for a phone that you can swipe your finger on, there wasn't one. That's where good marketing takes place, is where they've convinced you that you need that.
But usually the entrepreneurial spirit doesn't start with a concept of marketing. It usually concept that it's driven by self-motivation. I want to do something. Say you got over the last 5 years, you were pushed out of your job or forced to retire because they were downsizing or eliminating your job. And so you weren't so old that you were saying, okay, I'm going to just sit back and draw Social Security. You get motivated by the idea, I have this hobby or I have this craft or I have this skill that I'm going to start a business and sell it or promote it and still make a living, try and make money off of that uniqueness about myself.
And what separates the entrepreneurs from the rest of us is I can't tell you how many times I've heard somebody say, well, I thought of that. But did you carry it to fruition?
Yes.
Thinking of it's one thing.
Like the cardboard that we have folded up in our dashboard to keep our car cool from the hot sun.
That's right. And I watched a man who was very sick with lung disease, who had retired, lost several fortunes in several companies. And the last one that he started from scratch was the one that made his fortune. And he was retired when I knew him, and he had a severe respiratory disease. And I watched this man, because he was bored at being retired, as sick as he was, he made a $5,000 budget and decided he was going to invent this little device that people use to help him breathe a little better. And he went and found someone way out in Cottonwood that had a manufacturing for compressed molding. And I just watched him develop and manage this whole project. And he was an entrepreneur. And as sick as he was and as unneedful as money as he was, he couldn't help himself. For him, it was a pastime.
But it took guts and determination and persistence for him just to accomplish that, even as sick as he was. Any entrepreneur has that drive to be successful, to get income, make a living off of something that he does.
And you know what's amazing to me, entrepreneurs that I've known in the past, in spite of the fact that really it takes a very large ego to know that you can do this and to have the gall to produce this great thing, most of them are very humble in a lot of ways.
Oh, exactly. I don't think that they're arrogant or necessarily egotistical as so much as they're driven from within, that they have these high expectations of themselves. They have some leadership quality, but they, and it's not necessarily being in the right place at the right time. It's they come up with the right idea for the right problem at the right time.
So I have some definitions of what it means to be an entrepreneur from some different sources. According to the SBA, an entrepreneur is a person who organizes and manages a business undertaking, assuming the risk for the sake of profit. They see an opportunity, make a plan, start the business, manage the business, and receive the profits. It's a pretty clear process, but all of those pieces have to be in it for it to be a true entrepreneur.
And it's not every entrepreneur has all of those skills, and oftentimes they fail. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit more after the break, but I love the story of your granddaughter and the initiative that someday she's going to be an entrepreneur because of her initiative and drive. And that speaks of entrepreneurial features in little kids. You know, it's the kid that decides he's going to mow the lawn and take his allowance and buy a lawnmower and go mow the neighbor's yard so he can make more money. He wants to take control of his money at a teenage, you know, some of them are 10 and 12 years old.
And I think it is about controls. A true entrepreneur just can't relinquish control of their future over to someone else. That's why the kid goes out and buys a lawnmower. His parents might have given him one for free, but he doesn't think that way. He wants to own it. He wants everything to be on his dime.
Yeah, it goes back to the lemonade stand where the little girl goes out and buys lemonade and mixes it with water and sits out on the stand out on the sidewalk and sells it at 10 cents or 50 cents a glass, whatever. But she has got the determination, I want to do it myself, I want to be in control, and yet I need to make money.
Do we have time to go over that little story about the granddaughter?
Yes, absolutely.
I was... My family loves my homemade tortillas, and I was at my daughter's house in Ohio, and we were making tortillas, and everybody wanted them right away, and my little five-year-old granddaughter wanted to help, and I did give her one little piece of the project. I think, I forget what it was now, but she wanted to do more, and I said, well, we're in a hurry, so I kind of refused her, but she watched my process. And she just kind of started inserting herself into different parts of the process. She would lift a lid for me. She'd pull out one of the little balls. She would put the lid back. She would move a plate. She just kind of looked at the situation, decided what would be the most efficient way to help me, and ignored my request not to help me, and helped me anyway, and did a very good job. It was a very smooth process when we were done.
She saw the need, and she fulfilled the need.
And she could not help herself, regardless of kind of being told that her help wasn't needed, which I regret doing that, but it didn't matter. Didn't care.
She has got that spirit that you see in an entrepreneur.
That's right. And I think it happens from childhood. A true entrepreneur is someone who is just like that. The confidence they have in themselves, I don't think is the kind of confidence that some egoists have. I think it's just an automatic thought. Well, I can do that better. They're not thinking that they are better.
No.
They just to them, it makes perfect sense. Well, here's a better way to do that. And obviously, I have to do it.
Yes. And because of their... leap of faith in themselves to do it the right way or the more efficient way, they will invest in themselves. And that's the risk-taking part of it.
That's right. And they just don't see it in a fearful way. I don't think many good decisions are made when they're made out of fear. I think in most cases, it'll end up badly. It's not the right thing to make a decision out of fear. And they don't even think about it. I think the risk is just a part of their analysis. It's not the gut emotion that a lot of people have.
No. And I'd like to go over after the break a little bit about how to make it successful and some of the things that you have to overcome as an entrepreneur over and above those skill sets that you need. So we'll take a quick break and come back to that.
Join Shane, Local Motion, on Fridays at noon for a taste of music by local talent.
Like to peek behind the curtain? Join Doug Bennett on Saturday mornings at 9 a.m. for Unspun, Experiment in Truth Telling.
for your listening enjoyment of obscure and independent music. Tune in on Tuesdays at 9 a.m. to hear Don Fennell's Lost and Found. Currently, you're listening to Examine Life with Pat and Steve on KKRN 88.5, Bella Vista in Round Mountain. This is Examine Life on KKRN, 88.5 FM in Bella Vista at Round Mountain. Today we're discussing entrepreneurs.
And inventors. And we're going to talk a little bit about the entrepreneur, the possibility of failure. A lot of new businesses fail, and it's not usually because the entrepreneur didn't have a good idea. Most of the time it's all the other aspects of running a business that sinks a business. And oftentimes, it's failure to plan rather than the product or the idea wasn't a good idea.
Or it could be just the lack of experience with this particular type of business or this area of business, so that you didn't really know what to plan for. You may have been that kid who had the lawn mowing business, and then you decide to start up a shoe store, and you don't really understand the competition, and maybe you didn't realize how much deep investigation and research you had to do just because you don't have the experience yet.
And a lot of it is competition, or you don't assess your competition. They may be leapfrogging ahead of you on products or ideas that you haven't even thought of yet, or you haven't analyzed the market, meaning the demand for what it is you sell. You know, if you're the last guy coming in selling buggies that horses draw when cars are being invented, you are in the wrong place at the wrong time.
And I think probably what separates the entrepreneur from everyone else is that when you fail to do that planning and your business crashes and burns, you give up on yourself and you say, I guess I'm not an entrepreneur. Whereas an entrepreneur would say, well, how am I going to do it differently next time?
Exactly.
With no thought of not continuing on.
Right, exactly. And sometimes it's about the numbers, the dollars and cents. You have to have a plan financially. You have to make sure that the dollars and the time are manageable and achievable in order to get a return on your investment. Otherwise, you're just going to be spending money and never making any money. And how long can you do that?
Absolutely. Well, if you're in government, you can do it for a long time. If you're in business, you can only do it till you run out of money. It's also about delegation. In order to truly grow a business, you have to be able to delegate some of the tasks, because that's how That's how the entrepreneur themselves becomes financially successful, is they multiply their efforts and their abilities. And in order to do that, you have to start delegating to other people so that they can do more of the work that you were doing, freeing you up to do the work on a larger scale to make the thing grow. But delegation means that you have to have faith in your ability to understand people and pick the right ones to achieve your vision.
Or partner up with someone who has the attributes that you lack. Many, many businesses were very successful based on partnerships.
Very much so. I've been lucky in that way myself. You also have heard the phrase before, or the sentence, that the wise business leader surrounds himself with people smarter than him or her. And that is absolutely true. You don't have, as an entrepreneur, you don't have a fear that they're going to do better than you, because you have confidence. You want those intelligent people. But I will say from personal experience that sometimes you can hire that office manager, for instance, who really does everything you need them to do and more. Watch out. They're going to end up starting their own business. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. That was the kind of person you wanted. But along with that personality comes somebody who says, I think I could do this for myself.
Exactly. And if you don't have a big investment in your business to, as far as startup costs, it's easy for your employees to go off and do that to you. But it goes back to planning. It's really hard for every entrepreneur to have all the skills. And oftentimes we have to partner up with someone else. And sometimes that partnership is about money, an investor, rather than it is about they have the ability to do accounting and I don't.
That's right. It just depends on what talents you lack and the recognition that you lack them and the ability to pick the right partner that's going to be able to fill in those gaps and also has maybe the gaps that you need to fill in.
And this brings us to inventors. There have been, let's talk a little bit about some of the inventions, inventors, and tie that back into running a business. To define an inventor, it's the noun version for invent or discover, fabricate, produce from one's imagination or ingenious thinking. And everything from airplanes to Zillow probably started out as a wild idea to somebody, and it's their ingenious ideas and their vision that created it into a business.
I love the TV commercials that have been on recently. It's about buying a car, but it goes through the opportunities that this guy has had that he passed up on. One of them is his girlfriend who he breaks up with her, and then he sees her on TV and she's walking the red carpet and he's like, oh my gosh. And then you see him talking to a friend of his about an investment his friend wants him to make, and he says, I just don't get it. 120 words doesn't make any sense to me. And then it shows them both standing on a yacht, and his friend walks up to him and says, now do you get it? So he decides to buy the car.
Yes. And again, it's risk taking. And these inventors either filled a need, as in, you know, when they inventions have been going on since, you know, 5,000 years B.C. Paper was invented by the Egyptians from papyrus then. And China came along and refined that idea later, with silk, the byproduct of silk. China made new types of paper. But silk was only invented 4,000 years ago. So there was a long time in between the marriage of those two inventions.
And I think vellum came from sheepskin, isn't it? Uh-huh. That is a paper that, you know, was considered high quality. And when it was done on vellum paper, it must really mean something.
Well, look at eyeglasses. They were invented in about 1270. And then the concave lenses didn't get, you know, refined until the 1400s. And then the arms on them, where they could hang them on your ears, they weren't even hooks yet. They just was a bar attached to them. That happened in the 1600s. Bifocals, Benjamin Franklin, our very own Benjamin Franklin invented bifocals. Then they added the hinged arms so that they would open and close and you could fold them up and put them away.
And it kind of explains a little bit about inventors. Again, inventors, like entrepreneurs, which don't confuse them as being the same thing, but inventors have a combination of traits. Benjamin Franklin, for instance, was, you know, he was a what's the word they use, a bohemian. You know, he used to take what he called air baths. He had a lot of strange behavior.
Eccentric is the word you're looking for.
But that kind of behavior, you would just be strange or eccentric unless you also have the smarts to see a vision and to invent those bifocals and actually make something happen.
And being the eccentric, he didn't see it as being eccentric. Other people saw him as being eccentric because they didn't understand the vision process that he was going through.
That's right. You can't, I think a true entrepreneur does not accept other people's vision of them. They know who they are, they know who they want to be, and that's going to define all of their actions.
A lot of times it's sheer curiosity. Sometimes it's a need or a want. Marshmallows were, they were looking for a sweet. The Egyptians created it from palm roots. It was a candy 3,000 years ago. That's the same kind of marshmallow we eat today, except, of course, it doesn't have marshmallow root in it now. It's made from pure sugar, but the same concept. It's a need for something or a want of something that drives creativity.
And I think that's true of a lot of invention, but I had mentioned before the iPhone, and I remember the commercials when they were first promoting that phone. They were showing a person swiping the screen. And there really is not a need there, you would think. But what he did was, with the commercials and the marketing, they created a need. People just thought, I have to have that.
Well, the computer, we in the office environment, you know, the greatest machine that ever came along was a fax machine, you know, short of the typewriter. And then comes along a revolutionary piece of machinery called the computer. And most people didn't want it.
No, they thought that it had to fill up rooms. There's a very good television series on right now on one of the TV stations about the development of the personal computer out in the kind of the Silicon Valley of Texas. And it does show the process whereby people thought that computers were for big giant companies and space agencies, not for the everyday person. And someone had a vision that said, no, I think we can do this for the everyday person.
Well, I think it was a mystery because it wasn't tangible. Something was going on in that machine that wasn't really punching buttons in and hitting another button to add it all together like a calculator, you know, the old hand adding machines. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a typewriter where you could actually see it hit the paper. There was something mysterious going on in that box.
I still remember the first computer I had was a Commodore. And I was mesmerized by the fact that I had a machine that I could converse with. And I was hooked from that very first day. And then when I saw what it could do with spreadsheets, that was just icing on the cake.
Well, the power behind it was intimidating. But once you learned to master it and you were no longer afraid of it, then it became a fabulous tool.
And that's exactly why we got the Commodore. Just a little side story, as I had told my wife back in the early 80s, very early 80s, that I was afraid of these new machines. And I didn't like being afraid of something. And I was trying to decide what to do with it. And then Valentine's Day, a couple of years later, she got me a computer. And very short period of time, I wasn't afraid of them anymore and was fascinated with them. And that was in the mid-80s when things were still quite a bit different than they are today.
And the refinement of that, if you think back to the light bulb in Thomas Edison, where he created a light bulb which was based on electricity, but electricity was not commonplace. It was something that nobody really had in their home. And so he, despite his fabulous invention, he had to partner with somebody like J.P. Morgan, who was an investor. Now we call them venture capitalists, I think. But he was an investor then. But he had the idea of, we need to generate a power plant. We need to make a power plant that creates electricity that goes to a house.
And we had a discussion about him some time ago. J.P. Morgan, where you described him as an entrepreneur and I just described him as a financier. But in the end, I think you win that argument because of the fact that while Edison was the inventor of the device, J.P. Morgan didn't just provide money. From my understanding, he provided money. He put together the infrastructure or caused all that to happen. And that's the difference between an inventor and an entrepreneur. Edison is the one who's remembered for the invention of the light bulb, but putting it in every home was the function of an entrepreneur, not the inventor.
Right. And the it was the partnership of the two of them that made that successful. And ironically, there's now a guy by the name of John Gosha that's come out with a company. He's the founder of Finally Light Bulb is the name of the company. But he's invented a hybrid light bulb that is half incandescent, looks and like a light bulb. But the power is electrical through a tightly wound copper coil in the bottom half of it. And that in the neck of it, and that's creating an electromagnetic field that transfers energy into this bulb part of it that is a gas. It's coated with phosphorus. But the whole idea that he's reinventing the light bulb because of the new laws, they won't let us use those old ones. But he's come up with a new hybrid, you might say, that solves the problem, and we still get what we wanted, which was the original light bulb that screws into those little places that we have in our lamps and we're so resistant to give up.
Why does he call it the Finally light bulb?
I don't know. Just I just recently stumbled across him as, yes, here he is. He's, you know, solved a problem, which was we didn't want to throw away our lamps and all the little gadgets that we have that have a screw-in light bulb.
Oh, I see. So it's the power of this is that it can be used in a conventional, well, I mean, the LED lights can be used that way as well.
Right, but this gives off the same look of incandescent light. So, and it has the same shape as our original light bulb. So it's something that we will accept more readily. Just like once you got acceptance of that computer, your idea of releasing it into a telephone handheld little device was hard because giving up that keyboard was hard. Well, now we embrace the phone because it's a hybrid of a telephone and the little keyboard.
And a lot of other things. I don't know what phones are going to eventually become. And it's amazing, a lot of the inventing that's done now, again, creates a need. Some of the things that we're doing with smartphones and with the websites and the social media and all of those aren't necessities, but they seem to create the necessity, which I guess is a function more of sales than entrepreneurialism.
Well, that and the uniqueness. If you go back, one of the things that's happened more so with the U.S. Patent Office is the idea of corporate patents and corporate invention. And you go back to, Edwin Land, who was invented photography the way we know it out of a Polaroid camera.
Polaroid Land camera.
Camera, exactly. But when he started out, it was his patent, but he worked for Polaroid. And eventually, all the companies got wise to the idea, you're working for me on my time, so it's my patent.
And I think that's a valid thing. If you're spending your own money, then it should be your patent. But if you're spending, you know, they're paying you for the time, and then you invent this idea, that makes sense. Although I'm one of the libertarians who believes that no corporation should have any of the rights that a human has.
And I don't think that my great idea is your right because you have the money that it should be your patent.
Well,
if
no.
Anything, it should be shared.
Well, possibly, but you know, the idea remains again that you did it on their time and probably on their dime.
But again, it's the uniqueness is my idea, and you never would have had it. I could have gone somewhere else to get time and money, but you could not have gone anywhere else to get my idea.
But I think that's something that as an entrepreneur, you should have thought about ahead of time before you told them what you discovered. You should, in other words, once you've done it on their time and on their dime, and then you bring it to them, I don't know. I don't think you have any more rights because they're the ones, whoever, what if it was a small guy that you started, that started a business and you worked for him, and then you invent this great device on his time and his dime, and then you run off and market it, and all of a sudden he's in trouble after him giving you a job and all of this. So I think that same rule applies to corporations.
I'm sorry, he only bought my time. He did not buy my brain and my ideas.
But it was done on his time. How does he get compensated for that?
It'd be different if he was in the business of R&D, like IBM and the sticky note. I mean, that guy accidentally invented something on the job that he was IBM was paying him to do research and development on a different but similar type of idea of a sticky note. And he accidentally invented the sticky note. And I can see where IBM, that's their patent, because they hired him to do research and development. But if I just happen to invent something because of my own great idea, but I happen to be working for you, I don't feel that you have the right to take my patent.
So even if I hired you to work on this widget and you use my time that I'm paying you for to work on this widget, that you somehow have the right to keep that when I was essentially paying you to develop that, apparently.
No, not if... If we're talking about research and development, that's different. Whereas if you hire me to do a job at your company, and in doing that job, I see a need or an opportunity for something else to fit into the efficiency of that, and I go forward and invent it while I'm working for you, but I might even do it in my garage or after hours or driving in my car or whatever, the idea comes to me, and I put it together. But because I'm working for you, I don't think you deserve that patent unless you pay me to do research and development.
Well, no, but when you set up that specific situation where the part about working in your garage, I get. But if you invent it in the facilities of the business owner on the business owner's time, then that patent belongs to the business owner.
I understand that. If I'm in your chemistry lab, and my job is to do lab work based on research, then yes, that's true. But if I fulfill a need that just happens to parallel your business and solve a problem within that industry, then I don't think you deserve my patent.
Well, I agree. If you're not doing it on my time and my dime, sure, it's your own patent if you do it in your own garage. But if you're working for me and getting paid by me to do a specific job, either if I tell you to invent that device or work on it, it's obviously my patent. Or if I don't tell you, if I tell you to go fix that toilet and you work on that device, well, you just use my time when you should have been fixing the toilet to go work on that device. So those,
that's
I don't think that belongs to
the same scenario I'm thinking.
But if
of.
You if they're going home and doing it in their garage at night, well, sure, that shouldn't be the company's patent.
But not all inventions are a widget. Many things are to make your industry run smoother that may not, I can't think of something individually right now, but a lot of things are a byproduct of someone's job, but corporate America has structured everybody's job now, anything and everything you do while you work here for your lifetime of 4 years or 5 years is they own it.
Well, only because they made you sign a contract, right?
An employment contract. You can't, you know, there's all these non-compete and non-disclosures and all these other things that now corporate America thinks is part of your job. In order to get that job, you better sign that.
So,
and I don't think that's fair.
Well, it's not a matter of being fair. Refuse to sign it and go out and start your own company.
I disagree. We'll take a little break on that note.
Join Shane, Local Motion, on Fridays at noon for a taste of music by local talent.
Like to peek behind the curtain? Join Doug Bennett on Saturday mornings at 9 a.m. for Unspun, Experiment in Truth Telling.
For your listening enjoyment of obscure and independent music, tune in on Tuesdays at 9 a.m. to hear Don Fennell's Lost and Found. Currently, you're listening to Examine Life with Pat and Steve on KKRN 88.5, Bella Vista in Round Mountain.
This is Examine Life on KKRN at 88.5 FM in Bella Vista at Round Mountain. Tonight we're talking about inventions and entrepreneurs.
An invention is a unique or novel device, method, or composition or process. The invention process is a process within an overall engineering and product development process. But again, we're talking about physical inventions. There are much more. Invention is a whole universe unto itself.
And sometimes necessity is the mother of invention.
Such as the necessity to keep warm 10,000 years ago.
Fire, it not only kept us warm, it lighted our cave and heated our food.
So while we don't know a lot about fire, we know that initially it's something that we probably discovered when lightning caused a fire or something else caused a fire and we stole it from nature. And that old movie that I used to love so much, Quest for Fire, they had to have a fire keeper that kept the fire lit all of the time until they learned how to make it. Someone had to come up with that idea, and it's an amazing thought to think that someone that however many thousands of years ago found that friction or sparks could create a fire.
Think about the guy that's out there in outside of his cave and lightning strikes and causes a bush to catch fire. And he sees that it illuminates everything, and it's close enough to the cave that it illuminates his shadow on the cave. And he gets this grand idea, we'll bring it in the cave.
Yeah, and then they all die of carbon monoxide poisoning. We have to wait another generation to get fire.
Now, it's an open cave, okay? It's ventilated. So he gets light, which may have been his motivation in the beginning, and then brings it in the cave, realizes it heats it up, makes it warm. And then the first time they kill something and he stumbles in, drops it in the fire, and it gets cooked. I mean, it's marvelous, the concept of invention, the fire invention.
And you know, it turns out, I used to think that the cooking thing had to do with flavor. But it turns out that meat especially, is easier to digest when it's cooked.
I don't think the caveman was thinking that.
No, I think they were. I don't think they were thinking that. I think they found that when you ate meat that way, things just went better.
Maybe, possibly.
That's what the naturalist or the anthropologist discovered, at least, was that probably the reason that meat they took to cooking meat was because the digestion was easier. They just didn't think about it as digestion.
And the invention process, if you think about it, from the wheel to tools, and we even have archaeologists have delineated segments of history based on the tools they used, the Bronze Age, because they were using tools made of bronze at that time. But if you didn't live in the right part of the country that had metals in the soil, that's not what you would have been able to invent.
No, and so you were beaten by the guys that had the copper or later on the iron weapons, and you had to find ways to get those. But think about what it took to discover that you could smelt iron, or even that there was such a thing as iron. I'm always amazed by the initial inventors.
And the opportunity that must have arose at the time to spark their imagination to envision this.
The guy that first, going back to fire, the guy or gal that first started fire, making fire from scratch. If you've ever tried to do that, it's an amazingly complex process, and to have someone go through the whole process of either finding the right stones to make the sparks and then making the material that you use to initially catch the spark and start the fire and then having to blow on it, it's just amazing to me that someone or some group of people actually did that. I'm sure it was an evolutionary process.
My sons could tell you a little bit about causing fire from spark, and it was nothing more than throwing metal over the side of a hill that hit a rock, and the spark from that caused this fire. But, of course, they didn't have metal when they had fire, most likely, so that was probably not an opportune
The idea of making a fire from friction takes a lot of work and a lot of time, just exactly done the right way. So for someone to come up with that just amazes me. You know, things like the iPhone, well, that was built on the shoulders of others who invented different types of electronics. But the fire guy had to be a first idea.
Great visionary. Yeah. Or stumbled across, he was in the right place at the right time when that lightning struck and they preserved fire from fire to fire to fire.
Well, but then to create it, to create a fire on your own.
Yes, that was a monumental task, I'm sure. And it may have been discovered by accident. Who knows? But getting back to other more modern day inventions, I want to talk a little bit about a competition that we touched on earlier. And the government, during Rockefeller's industry building of Standard Oil, the monopoly became a problem. And the government stepped in and broke up that monopoly. But a lot of what happens now in government and politics is we eliminate competition. Corporate America goes to our legislators and they pass some law that eliminates competition, or they go out and they buy the patent of another inventor and they put it on the shelf and kill that technology. And that's the downside of invention today.
Well, and as always, politics tends to ruin just the beauty of freedom to invent and to build something without interference or without collusion with any kind of a governmental body making all these laws and rules and regulations. I mean, I understand the patent process. If you are an inventor who invents something, or again, our discussion before about someone who creates an invention while working for someone else, you know, you have to think about the individual. If you're the one who made that invention and maybe you made it in spite of the boss telling you that it was going to lead nowhere, you have a personal stake in that, and you have a right to feel violated if they take over your patent. But as a business owner, if someone invented something on my time, I would take an onus against having that person be able to create a patent for that when I was paying them to do a job.
We invite invention here in the United States, and we will even supply the capital to make it grow. There are sites online now that if you have a great idea, they will take your idea and see test market it for you and eventually possibly take it to market for you. The beauty of America and the opportunity is fabulous. There are many facets of patent law. I mean, everything from arts, artistic creation, to intellectual properties, to, you know, actual widgets.
The fact that we constantly have patent battles going on tells you how vague the patent laws really are. Our technology has outpaced what the laws describe.
And I think that's why a lot of these patent challenges wind up in court. Sony and Apple just went through how many years and years of fighting over patents, and then one wins, and then they challenge it in the next level of courts, and then it gets reversed. And so, but the idea, our patent office idea is fabulous.
But again, with patents, you get involved in courts, and that's always going to bog down the system. So there's some thought that a lack of any patent laws could probably be a viable way. Business would just be done differently.
A good example of that is the court ruling that Henry Ford had to go through because his competitors tried to prohibit him from inventing the Model A or Model T, whichever the first one was, and selling it so cheap to everybody. It was actually the competitors trying to keep him out of business, but he won that in court.
What was their basis?
It had something to do with competition, had to approve your company as a company. And if you think about it, it's absurd. Who would say, yes, I'll allow you to be my competitor? Nobody would voluntarily do that.
Well, that's why government should, in my opinion, not be involved in anything other than what they originally were supposed to be in the Constitution. If you look at New York City, what I've seen is that it costs about $1 million to get a medallion to own a cab in New York City. And those were clearly rules that were set by the existing giant cab companies to prevent the little guys from getting a cab.
As were the automakers back in Henry Ford's day.
And so, again, having the government involved, and when you go in court, that's what you're doing, essentially, is the wrong thing. But that's where people go crying to. I mean, isn't it a standard American phrase, there ought to be a law?
Yes.
It's the first place people go, well, how are you doing with all that? We have a lot of laws now.
But it's still a great country. And that about wraps up our show for this evening.
I'm Steve.
I'm Pat.
You've been listening to Examine Life on KKRN 88.5 FM, Bella Vista and Round Mountain.
And we'll see you on the couple Mondays from now.